Well, good evening and welcome to
the fifth presentation in this, our eighth series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my absent colleague, Peggy Wright, who's recovering from a cold. With help from our webmaster here taking pictures and recording the podcast, Haiwan Wan, and our reference coordinator, Brian Carson, there at the back. Daniel Peach designed our posters. Our technical specialist tonight is the library's technology coordinator, David Runner. Our speaker tonight is a native of Henderson, Kentucky, and after a BA at Austin Peay University in Clarksville, Tennessee, he attended graduate school at WKU, receiving his MA in history in 2001. He continued his education at the University of Kentucky, where he received a PhD in history in 2006. He's taught history and political science at Midway College, at the University of Kentucky, at Northern Kentucky University, at Murray State University, and recently finished a year teaching at West Point. He first became interested in looking into German prisoners of war while a graduate student at Western Kentucky University, and he wrote his thesis on the topic. His first book, German Jackboots on Kentucky Bluegrass, was later expanded from that thesis and published by Diversion Press in 2008. In 2010, the University of Tennessee Press published his newest book, Men in German Uniforms, POWs in America During World War II, which examines the fate of some 371,000 German soldiers housed in the United States between 1941 and 1947. Professor Thompson and his wife are the parents of three children and reside in Clarksville, Tennessee. Please give a warm welcome to Antonio Thompson. Antonio?
Thank you for the introduction, Brian. Thank you for having me out here, too. It's an honor and a pleasure to come here, especially for so many reasons. Usually I give part of that introduction as my beginning talk. Why am I doing this project? But I'll still talk about that because the project that has resulted in the book that I'm talking about and the second book, it began here in Bowling Green. It began at Western Kentucky University. When I was a graduate student looking for my thesis topic, we always want to find something that hasn't been overdone, something new, something fresh. I see some heads nodding out there. Something exciting, and more than that, it's got to be something we are going to be excited about working on. Obviously, I found a topic that I have found exciting. I've worked on it now for numerous years. But I was in one of my classes here, Nazi Germany, with Dr. Jack Thacker, and he mentioned just in passing, it wasn't even part of the lecture. Before class started, he said something about, oh, there were some German prisoners of war kept in Kentucky. And then he just moved on. And looking for a thesis topic, I got my pad of paper out and jotted that down and thought that would be something I would look into a little bit later. One of the first places I stopped in that search was at this bookstore where I purchased a book called Nazi Prisoners of War in America by Arnold Kramer. So it brings the whole thing sort of full circle. I started the project at Western for my master's degree, and the very first book I picked up on that search, I ordered here and picked it up here at this bookstore what seems like so many years ago. But I'm here tonight to tell you about the German prisoners of war. It's an untold or little told and little known episode of our World War II history. By the time the war is over, we will have housed 371,000 Germans in the continental United States. And I'm talking about the Germans, but if I wanted to expand that discussion, I would tell you that we had 50,000 Italians also held as prisoner, and just under 6,000 Japanese prisoners held in the United States. That's not including anyone that was held overseas, just the numbers brought here to the United States. When the war started for us, for the United States, December 7th, 1941, the bombing of Pearl Harbor, we had tried and discussed and hoped in many ways to stay neutral. When we were looking at going to war and thinking about the war coming to us, one of the last things we talked about was how to handle prisoners of war. That wasn't very important. when we're talking about a two-front global war looming in front of us. But that became something we were shoved right in our face on that day that Pearl Harbor was bombed, because that's the day that we picked up our first prisoner of war, a Japanese submarine pilot. Moving on from there, we entered the war properly into the next year and the year after. We're picking up Germans on the high seas. We are picking up Germans in the combat in North Africa. And as the war goes on, we will arrive on the shores of France and move through France and ultimately into Germany itself, where we will pick up hundreds of thousands of prisoners of war. So the first question that I usually get when I give these talks, why did we bring those prisoners to the United States? Why did we bring 371,000 prisoners across the Atlantic Ocean? Why were over 9,000 of those prisoners housed in Kentucky? The quick answer to that is that we signed something called the Geneva Convention of 1929. By ratifying that convention, we've agreed to certain humane standards of treatment. The prisoners must be protected, they must be fed the equivalent food that our soldiers get, housed in the equivalent housing, water, electricity, clothing, you name it. That's expensive. It's expensive to get that material overseas. And if our first theater of combat is North Africa, that's where that stuff has to go. As Americans living in this country during that time, how would we justify shifting troops or supplies for troops off of those boats in order to have stuff for prisoners of war take that place? You really wouldn't be able to. You couldn't justify that. And even if we did that, one of the stipulations is that we have to keep the prisoners safe from harm's way. You can't guarantee in North Africa or later in France that a German counterattack, a German bomb, German planes won't blow up, attack, or destroy some of these prisoner installations. But what we could do is we could guarantee that when those ships bringing soldiers and supplies to the combat zones returned, they returned typically empty. Wounded would come back, some nurses would accompany them, small numbers of personnel would return. But otherwise, the ships would return relatively empty. We decided then that we would fill those ships with the Germans and Italians we were capturing in North Africa. We would bring them over to the United States. It would be a good way to keep them safe. We could provide all the material they needed, food, clothes, shelter, without the extra expense of shipping that overseas. And that's how we did it. Ultimately, 425,000 Axis POWs would make trips across the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean to the continental United States. Now that sounds all good and well, but the first real problem that we encountered was the fact that we had nowhere to put these people. You can say that they need to be in certain accommodations, but we just did not have those accommodations. So for instance, one of the first things we looked at was space on existing military facilities. That's hard to find. We were lucky in Kentucky that we had three operational camps at that time: Camp Breckinridge, Camp Campbell, and Fort Knox. Each of those camps had soldiers deploying overseas. That emptied off some room. We were able to convert some of that space to what became permanent prisoner of war compounds. Each camp was designed to hold 3,000 prisoners of war. That worked out for us in Kentucky. But for the smaller camps in the state, there were over 11 smaller camps. And for camps in other states, they didn't always have that luxury. They would have to find areas that would meet all the requirements that the Geneva Convention and the State Department and the War Department called for. That was very difficult. So in many cases, these things were being built from scratch. In Danville, Kentucky, for instance, where we housed prisoners of war, there was no camp. There were no facilities, so we built a tent camp. We housed prisoners in Danville in tents. But the Geneva Convention specified that the prisoners had to have the same accommodations as the guards of the holding power. We circumvented that by putting the guards in tents. Easy enough to do. In Maysville, there was no good place for a camp. but we needed prisoners to be housed in Maysville. In Maysville, there's a park still there, big baseball field, big baseball fences. And the War Department looked at that spot and thought, well, there's clear ground. The guards can see fairly well because kids played baseball there. Fences are already there. We can just augment those fences, put a guard tower in, and convert that baseball diamond into a prisoner of war camp. That's what they did in Maysville. And this is what happens throughout Kentucky and throughout the nation. Over 600 camps are built, many of them tent camps, converted baseball fields, converted amusement parks. We had a thing in the 30s called the Civilian Conservation Corps. As that starts becoming closed down, we use those barracks and convert those sites into prisoner of war camps. So we're doing this, but it's a slow process, and we're getting prisoners in far quicker than we're able to find this space. So there's, in the middle of discussing how to fight the war and finding about our casualties and worrying about our ships going over there and soldiers dying, we are trying to figure out where we're going to put these prisoners of war. That's how we do it. It's a very slow process. It takes a long time. In the meantime, the prisoners are arriving, and they're arriving by the thousands. They're coming to places like Camp Shanks, New York. Camp Shanks is one of the big embarkation points for our soldiers going overseas. So, of course, those ships that transport them are coming back to Camp Shanks, and they're coming filled with German prisoners of war. Another point is Norfolk, Virginia. Lots of ships coming in full of prisoners of war. A third place, not used quite as much, New Orleans, Louisiana. But Camp Shanks, New York, Norfolk, Virginia are the big places where the prisoners arrive. Now, we are getting thousands of prisoners to these places. They have to be brought from New York to Kentucky and everywhere else across the nation. And one of the first things these prisoners discover is they get to a place like New York, and they see the big buildings. They see the army facilities. They see the bustling of busy people doing things. And they're surprised. They didn't know that this was how big the nation was. Some of the prisoners actually have the, I want to say audacity, but in some cases it's probably more confusion to say, well, we've been hearing and reading over in Germany that the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, has bombed New York to rubble. And some of these guys say, well, apparently the Americans build faster than the Luftwaffe destroys. But the truth of the matter is, when they get on the trains, and that's how they're transported, is by train, they crisscross the nation, a couple of things stand out that they haven't had in Europe in years. They can look out of those windows. The lights in the trains are on. The lights in the cities they go through are on. And in Europe, they have to have the lights off because that will be a target for planes to know where to drop their bombs. And that stands out to the Germans. That's something in their diaries. And the Germans that I have, former World War II veterans that I have interviewed, that they mentioned to me, stood out to them. The other thing that stood out was how big the nation was. As they're going on these trains for several days at a time, just miles clicking off day and night, day and night, how big the United States was. And some of them start to realize, and you'll read this in my book or in other accounts, that there was no way, they would say this, there was no way we could have won this war. America's too big. There's too many people, too many resources, and apparently they're not worried in America because the lights are on. They're not being attacked. So that's one of the things they would remark. Now, another thing, they said a few things about Kentuckians, and as my introduction said, I'm a native Kentuckian by birth, so I'm going to say this. They say a few things about Kentuckians that aren't very nice. As they're going through Kentucky, they make comments about how every house looks ramshackle and it's about to fall apart, but you better believe there's a new pickup truck in the driveway. I wrote that, but I didn't say that. I repeated it. and the trains would bring them to their new homes. And I'm going to talk about Kentucky specifically. They would bring them to their homes at Camp Campbell or at Camp Breckenridge or at Fort Knox. Fort Knox, for instance, was housing Italian prisoners of war all through the year 1943. So the guards out at Fort Knox were somewhat familiar with the task of taking care of prisoners of war. But those Italians, never more than about 50,000 in the whole country, were shifted out to go to Indiana to their new camp in order to make room for the arriving Germans. And the Germans would arrive at Fort Knox by a train that would bring them right into the camp. In the other camps, like Camp Campbell and Camp Breckenridge, the trains would bring them into towns like Clarksville, where the Germans would then be trucked into the camps. And this would happen also in the smaller camps across the state, the camp in Danville and Maysville, for instance. When we're constructing those camps, the Germans would be trucked in. This becomes a local spectacle. Now, as far as prisoner of war operations are concerned, it's technically a media blackout. We can't talk about it in the news, you can't read about it in the newspaper, but we do. You can go back and look at any of those newspapers. Every small town wanted to be the first one to print German POWs in our town, German prisoners at our train station, German prisoners housed at Camp Campbell, and everyone would come and watch these guys, these Nazi supermen, get off those trains or off those trucks or shuffled into the camps. And those three camps would be the big ones in Kentucky, Campbell, Knox, and Breckenridge. While the Germans are there, as I mentioned before, they're being taken care of, they're being fed the same amount that the American soldiers and guards are being fed, they're being housed the same way with running water and electricity at a time when the American population is rationing their food and using coupons and saving. The German prisoners are not. The German prisoners, in some cases, in the state of Kentucky, are enjoying, I keep leaning to this microphone for some reason, are enjoying a 3,000 calorie a day diet. Think about that for a minute. There is a period of time in 1944 when the Germans are enjoying 3,000 calories a day. Let me help you contrast that. The prisoners of war, even when they are enjoying 2,000 calories a day, are eating more as prisoners than they were eating in active duty German military service. When you are an active duty soldier, there are certain things that are required of you, like a certain level of physical fitness, a certain level of activity, and especially when you're in the combat area, you're not going to sit around and gain a lot of weight. Immediately upon becoming a prisoner, in some cases, your rations are doubled, and all those physical requirements are basically taken away. So the Germans are now sitting around in these camps, some for 4, 5, 6 years, and they are just gaining weight. They would write home letters, because we read all the letters. We had to censor them. They would write home letters. "Mom, you wouldn't recognize me if you saw me today. I have gained 40 pounds. One of the things that the Germans loved most about our food, or the food item, I should say, that the Germans loved the most, was peanut butter. Every account you will read, every former prisoner of war you will talk to, if you ask them about the food, they'll probably say there's a lot of it. And they'll say, "We loved peanut butter. We could sit around the table and eat a jar. And those jars came in those big army cans. And we could have as much as we wanted. And we wanted a lot of it." They ate a lot of peanut butter. And that sounds humorous. Until the American people who live in the same communities start to realize that the Germans are eating far better than they are. And when they find out on Thanksgiving, when the army is saying, "We need to sacrifice turkey and things like that to make sure the boys overseas have turkey," and they find out that in some cases there's a discussion of it, in other cases there's the actuality of it, but the Germans are getting turkey on Thanksgiving, a holiday that they don't really even celebrate. People become alarmed. and there's a backlash about the amount and quality of food the Germans are being given. The community, the public at large, has a backlash, and the War Department will argue that this is a Geneva Convention requirement. We're required to do that. There's nothing else we can do, because if we cut the rations, we're breaking Geneva Convention guidelines. And if we break them, then the Americans who are held in Germany will suffer for that. And we can't have that, and you wouldn't want that. However, in Kentucky, for instance, the protest goes on for so long and so loudly that eventually, for reasons unrelated to that, the calorie quantity is cut of German POW's food. That's the official statement. For reasons unrelated, the Germans have their food cut. Now, another way that we know about what the Germans are up to, how much food they're getting, is because those of us in the community are providing a lot of it. Same people, or the neighbors of people that are making complaints, are the ones providing it. There's the media blackout too. But keeping these prisoners at all these camps, feeding them, clothing them, housing them, it's not free, and it's not cheap. One of the things we decide to do, and we do so, and in the end it becomes very, very successful, is to put the prisoners to work. Put them to work. In World War II, we have a labor shortage. Young men are going off to war, and those who aren't fighting are working in a war industry, most likely. And the areas that are suffering the most are agricultural areas. And if we're talking about Kentucky, we're talking primarily tobacco. Secondary to that is corn. We need help. The American people need help. And the Germans are sitting around draining money. Why not put them to work? They are able-bodied young men. They are used to working hard. Put them to work in these fields. So we do. For instance, at Camp Campbell, we start to employ the Germans into tobacco fields all over Montgomery and Stewart County in Tennessee, Trigg County, Christian County, Todd County, Logan County, Kentucky. These guys will go out in groups of 5 or 10, sometimes 15 or 20, but usually in groups of 5 at a time, divisible by 5. One guard for every 10 is the rule. And they'll get out here and they'll work in the tobacco fields. And the farmers, I don't know if any of you work tobacco, that's pretty demanding work. And the farmers will say that these guys, at lunchtime, the guards will bring little sandwiches for them. And the farmers will say, we don't feed the farmhands sandwiches. This is grueling labor. They need to eat a little extra. So these guys on 2,000, 3,000 calorie a day diets are getting big, hearty farm lunches. Sometimes they're getting ice cream. A lot of times they get beer. Farmers give them cigarettes. Not supposed to do any of that. That is all against the regulations. But the farmers do that. Sometimes they mail letters for them. Really against the regulations. The censor doesn't read those letters. They just stuff them in their pants, ask the farmer to do them a favor. They often do. Now, as far as these guys working out in the public, that's when we really get to know something about the Germans. You will see people comment in the newspaper that if I didn't know any better, I would think they were just good old Kentucky boys. And then for the next 3 months, you'll have people writing in the editorial column complaining why that person would say such a thing. We needed blood. We needed to have the blood banks full. And someone said, well, why not get the blood from the German soldiers to help out with American boys who were wounded and needed blood? And there are a wave of letters coming into the newspaper. I wouldn't want anybody having that German blood. No American boy needs to have that running through their veins. So, you see, in the community, there's two sides to this. The people that benefit from it, the people are very angry. They're angry to have the Germans out there working amongst them. And the Germans were required to work. They had to work. If you were an enlisted German soldier, you had to work. If you refused to work, you were punished. You were put on food and water. You were put in solitary confinement, had your privileges taken 3, 4, 5 days until you decided you were going to go to work. And if you were a German officer, you didn't have to work. But if you chose to work, if you wanted to go out in the tobacco field, you didn't go as a laborer. you went as a supervisor, and you were getting paid the equivalent rate to an American of the same rank as you, and you would go as a supervisor. And initially, we thought, that's a pretty good idea. Let's get the officers out there to help supervise. If the soldiers are going to listen to anybody, it's their own officers. Germans are known for following orders, being very proper. And the officers could translate for us, hopefully. But what we soon discover is that every time the officers go with, whether it's at Kentucky camps or other camps, the soldiers end up doing less work, causing more problems. And we often find out that the officer is actually telling them to refuse to work or giving them different orders. So that's something we stopped doing as much. But even when the officers weren't out there, the German workers caused plenty of trouble if they wanted to. Not all of them did, but some of them did. Going on a work detail was a great opportunity for you to cause trouble. And one of the things that's a maxim, no matter what army you're in, no matter what war we're talking about, is to cause your captor as much trouble as possible. Cause them as much trouble as you can. And they do this sometimes on the farm fields here in Kentucky. If you've looked at my book, I've mentioned several stories of this. One story, a farmer here in Todd County needed extra work. And the prisoners were not required to work on Sundays. Sunday's a day off. But a bunch of the prisoners volunteered to work on Sunday for some extra time out of the camp and for some extra money. About 20 of them were taken from the camp. When they got to the farm field, they immediately sat down and refused to work. And they said they weren't going to work on a Sunday, even though they'd already said they would. So as punishment in that situation, the guard marched them all the way back to Fort Campbell, about 10 miles away. So that taught that group a lesson, perhaps. But usually the problems they caused at work were less easily identifiable. In one case, the farmer had the prisoners cutting tobacco, and they were housing the tobacco. And I don't know how many of you have ever housed tobacco, but when you house tobacco, you've got usually a guy in the wagon who hands a stick up, and then there's the rafters, and you spread your legs, and you reach down and grab the stick, and it either goes on your level, or you pass it up to the next level. If you've never done it, it's pretty nervous work until you get used to it. The Germans have never worked tobacco, so when they got into the barn, they weren't used to balancing themselves over these beams, 3, 4, and 5 tiers up into the barn. That's a pretty nice drop if you were to fall. So the prisoners took their belts off and tied them to the tier above them and then held onto their belts and reached down for each stick of tobacco. Now, I got that story from a farmer that I interviewed, and he said, "Have you worked in tobacco before?" And I said, "Yeah, I've worked in tobacco a little bit." He said, "Can you imagine how little work I got done with those guys?" And he said, "And the bunch I had always thought they deserved beer every day." Can you imagine that? But you don't get much done sometimes. Now, maybe that wasn't on purpose, but it was new work to them. They weren't used to it. And prisoners could cause problems in another unique way, too. They're required to work, and they're taken off the military post to go to work. And when they're working on these farms, they're out in the public eye. They see people from the local community. They work with civilians side by side with them in these farm fields. Especially the first prisoners that came from North Africa. These are young men living in the desert, muscular and tanned. And they come to our communities where our young men are over in Germany or France or not around. And sometimes they meet the local young ladies. And the young ladies will say things like, "If only we could meet later." Well, that sticks in the mind of a 20-year-old German prisoner of war who's been off the war for 3 years and in a prison camp for 4 years with a bunch of other German guys. "I'd like to meet you later." The problem is, the prisoner of war camps I'm talking about, Breckinridge, Knox, or Campbell, take any of them because it's the same setup. inside those camps, the prisoners live in the barracks. When they come out of those barracks, if they want to get out of that camp to go meet that young lady or to escape, for whatever reason they want to escape, there is a 12-foot-high fence. At the top of that fence is a 3-foot extra hangover barbed wire. Once you go through that fence, there's enough room, usually, for a Jeep, always enough room for a bunch of dogs to be let loose, and a second fence. The ground is clear, so every guard tower can see you, and the machine guns that they have can shoot you. If you try to get out of that camp, they are going to try to kill you. 2,222 Germans, I did not make that number up, 2,222 escaped from camps like that. Imagine that for a minute. They usually do it at night. They climb to that fence. They have to try to cut the wire, slide underneath it, hope the guard doesn't see them because he'll open fire and or let the dogs loose. Get to the second fence. Cut it. Get out. Camps are required to have at least 50 additional feet cleared of rocks, big rocks, brush, trees, for full visibility. So they've got to clear that area and then get out into wherever it is they're going. Doesn't happen a lot. Instead, a lot of Germans do get out of those camps, but instead, what most of them do is they volunteer to go work on the tobacco field, where there's one guard to every 10 prisoners. Sometimes there's one to every 20. And the guards are very friendly with the prisoners on these work details. The guards sometimes are older American soldiers, might need a little help climbing up in the back of the farmer's pickup truck, because the farmer carries them back and forth. The guard might need a hand from one of the Germans, and they're always happy to take his rifle for him. And the guard usually gives it. So he gives those Germans his rifle, and they help him up. And then when they go out into the tobacco field, for instance, the guard is trying to keep an eye on 10 or 20 guys. If you've ever seen a tobacco field, you know that you have, tobacco's high. You have to bend over. It's difficult to watch what everyone's doing. It's more difficult when many of the guards go take a nap under the tree, which they do. There are even instances of the guards telling the prisoner who finished his task early, "Hey, I'd like to take the shotgun out and go hunt some rabbits for the farmer. He said it'd be all right." "Well, if he said it's all right, go ahead." The guy goes out in the woods for 3 hours hunting rabbits. Now, if the average work detail is 8 hours of work and up to 2 hours time commuting, let's say that you're planning an escape. Let's say the guard goes to sleep or doesn't pay attention after the first hour. All you've got to do is squat down to that tobacco and go out into the woods. You've only got to get away from one guard. And if he doesn't pay attention, you have what, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours before he even notices that you're missing. And when he does notice, he's got to go back to camp and tell everybody. That's the best way to escape. And that's the way most of the prisoners do escape. Do they go meet those girls? Sometimes. One of the prisoners I interviewed had a very dear friend of his whole life, before the Army, after the Army. Dear friend of his, who met a girl in the same fashion while he was out in a farm detail. And she said, "If only you could come meet me. Come meet me at night out there by the old barn." And he didn't escape from the work detail, because that wouldn't get him close enough to night. It'd be easy to do it that way. But he took the hard way, and he escaped from the camp itself. And he did it 4 times and never was caught. Slipped out and back in to meet this young lady 4 times. When you ask the prisoners, "Why did you escape?" they usually give you 3 answers. One is a sense of freedom. Okay. 2 is to get beer. All right. And 3, and the most popular, is to find women. That's why they escaped. But they're risking death. They are literally risking death to escape. And here in America and here in Kentucky, we are afraid of an escaped German. We are very scared of this. These are people who are soldiers. They are killing Americans overseas. What, they are Nazis. What might they do when they escape over here? Will they kill anyone they come across? Are they going to blow stuff up? Are they going to commit all the sabotage and rape and murder? Are they going to go back to Germany? What is the game plan here? What are they going to do? Here's how a typical escape works. In the history of escapes, there were no rapes, no murders, no sabotage. Not one of those guys that escaped said, "I was hoping to go to Germany." No! I don't want to go back to the war. I have peanut butter here. They're not looking for that. And here's how the typical escape works. I haven't described this to you yet. I keep wanting to talk into this. The prisoners of war have these dyed denim uniforms that have PW stamped all over them. You may not have seen that, but you know what stencils are on clothes. Even if you took a sharp knife and scraped and washed these things over and over, the outline of that stencil is usually still visible from a good distance away. Not to mention the fact that they're wandering around in this denim uniform, which looks probably a little strange. And the prisoners don't know the geography. They don't know where they're going. So they escape in that uniform with no sense of where they're at. So they stick to the roads. So, all right, I'm looking for an escaped prisoner. He's got a uniform we can spot. He's going to stay on one of the roads because he's afraid to wander through the woods and might get lost. Most of them do not speak English. Some of them do. That's a secret they keep. If they can speak English, they make sure the Americans don't know it. That's a closely kept secret because they're going to use that against you in one way or another, whether it's to escape or to listen for sensitive information that you're discussing in front of them because you think they don't know English. But they're going to escape. Most of them don't know English. Most of them have no money because they're not paid in money. They're paid in canteen coupons, these little stamps that are only good at the camp that they're at to buy stuff like extra toilet paper or magazines. So how do they get money? Because some of them do have money. They're not allowed to have American money, but they use their canteen coupons to buy extra soap. And they take their knives and they carve German iron crosses and replicas of German military medals. And they go to the American guards and they say, "Wouldn't you like to have this souvenir? Wouldn't your kids like it, your dad or whoever? I'll sell it to you really cheap." And they do that, and these escape committees come together and they pull their money up. And the guy that escapes gets it. But that's rare. Most of these guys are broke. And they don't even have food with them. Some of them go out in the woods in Kentucky and pick a bunch of berries. Some of those berries aren't fit to eat. And they wander around like this a day, 2 days, if they're lucky, 3 days. And then they're recaptured. The police, in one case in my book I talk about, a school bus driver sees them. "Hey, I read about this guy in the paper." They swing by, this bus driver swings by and gets a farmer friend of his. They grab a shotgun in the school bus. "Let's go get this guy. He's down the road." They come barreling down. The kids are dropped off. Come barreling down the road. "You're escaped German." "Got me." That's how they surrender. Yep. No sense in running. I'm hungry. I'm ready to go back. Almost every time. Almost every time. In Trigg County, this is one of the stories I love the most. In Trigg County, and it's not very far from Fort Campbell, one of the Germans escapes, and the sheriff puts out an APB on this guy. We've got state police looking for him, local police, farm guys are coming together forming posses. Everybody's looking for him. The sheriff has to pick his daughter up from school. He gets her in the back of the car. He pulls off the side of the road. He's looking at his map. "I just don't know where this guy might be." And his daughter says, "Dad, is he 5'10" tall, probably, roughly? "Yeah, that's him." "Is he wearing a blue uniform with a PW on it?" "Yeah, that'd be him." "Is that him?" And he walked right by the car. The sheriff got out and said, "Gotcha." He said, "Yeah, you do." That's how it works. Almost every time. There's no resistance. They weren't fighting. They didn't, when the police came, in most cases, they didn't even try to run away. They were ready to go back. But we were so afraid. We were so afraid of the escapes. And there were other funny ones, too. Over at Fort Knox, a group of four guys decides they want to get out of the camp. And they don't want to dig under the wire. And they don't want to escape from a work detail. What they do is they go to the motor pool and steal an army jeep and fly right out the front gate in that jeep. Everybody knows that they left. Everybody's looking for them. They get to Horse Cave. They got away. And then, after laying low there for a few days, they go to Nashville, where they're attending musicals and stuff in Nashville before a bus driver. They're getting on and off the buses and stuff. It says, wait a minute. Are you guys supposed to be here? And he starts questioning them. And then he realizes, I've got some German prisoners of war who escaped. So they get apprehended. At Fort Campbell, then Camp Campbell, a couple of guys are going to be real creative. They steal an ambulance. They steal an ambulance, and they're driving off post at 2 o'clock in the morning. And the thing overheats. And an MP comes by and sees the guys in the ambulance trying to figure out how to put water in the thing. So he goes down the road and turns around to come help. But then he realizes, why is there an ambulance sitting here? So he goes back and finds out that an ambulance was not dispatched. So he pulls up to the ambulance, gets out, and finds out these are four German prisoners of war. Well, the MP, like a lot of young men then, knew how to work on vehicles. So he got out, got the ambulance running, and said, all right, I'm going to follow you right back to the compound. They got in the ambulance, and he escorted them right back. And they went back. That's the history of escapes. That's the history of escapes. And I was talking to you about labor. And the labor of the German prisoners, over 90% of the Germans held captive were put to work. And if you go back and look at any of those records and any accounts of what they did, yes, some refused, some escaped, but in most cases, once they learned how to work tobacco or learned how to work corn, you will find farmers all over this state and the Farm Bureau saying, if not for those prisoners of war, our crops would have failed. The 1944 and 1945 harvests would have failed. They saved us in that regard. I think they probably paid for their keep in that regard. Now, some of the stories I've told are kind of humorous, and some of the things the prisoners do are kind of humorous, but not all. I'm going to switch gears and talk about this problem in the camps that I address a little bit in the first book, the Kentucky book, and a lot more in the other book, Men in German Uniform. And the problem is that as we're capturing prisoners, we classify them as German, Italian, Japanese. Now, when we're in North Africa, if a guy's in a German uniform, you bet he's German. Now, we also think German means Nazi, and that's not true. But as the war drags on, the Germans are losing more and more troops. They're searching for how to keep their manpower up. They're occupying countries like Czechoslovakia and Poland, and they're forcing those guys into the army. They're turning out their prisoner of war camps and getting those guys to volunteer for the army. They're turning out their prisons and they're getting those guys into the army. They're getting people that they put in prison for their political beliefs of being opposed to the Nazis, and they're putting them in the army because they're searching everywhere for the manpower. You've got people, Ukrainians, you've got people from England, you've got Czechoslovakians, you've got Mongolians, everybody in the German army. And once they're behind barbed wire, a lot of their ideological problems come to light because there is not a war to keep them occupied anymore. So these problems will come to light too because the Nazi element that dominated Germany also will dominate the prisoner of war camps. And if you don't follow that code, if you break that code, then there are consequences that you will suffer. And you can break that code by speaking out against the Nazis. not following what they tell you to do. If you can speak and read English, if you read a New York Times paper and it says something like, Germans lose at Stalingrad, and you read that to the other Germans, you have just repeated American propaganda and spread defeatism among all the prisoners of war. That's enough to mark you as a traitor. And the Germans, the good Germans, the Nazis, make sure they get into positions where they can read the mail. They work in the mail room and read the mail the other prisoners are sending home. Now, the thing about I've gained 40 pounds, that's not as interesting to them as the guy who says, we're going to lose this war. And they pocket those letters. And they use things like that as evidence later when they bring these people to trial. They have trials, these midnight tribunals. Some of them are actually quite famous, where they accuse these people of being traitors and being defeatists. And those accused, they bring out this evidence. In the one of the famous cases is the Corporal Johann Kunz. They bring out a letter that he wrote to his wife that says, we're probably going to lose the war. And he signs off using some Muslim words that he had learned while he was in North Africa. Clearly, he is a traitor and a defeatist. And as they are reading his sentence at midnight when the American guards are not around, his sentence is death, so approved by a German military court-martial. And it's carried out immediately. The man is beaten to death. And that's how it happens in these camps. You slip up a little bit, you say the wrong thing, you talk to the wrong people. Oh, you're talking to the American guards? I saw you three times this week talking to the guard. What was that conversation about? Usually what they have is called the Holy Ghost. So when a man is found guilty, they have the Holy Ghost visit him. The Holy Ghost is someone from a different compound than you are. They take two people from that compound to carry out the sentence. And at night, those two men will come to where you are sleeping, and most of the other Germans will know this is coming. Those who don't know do not help you and do not say anything. One of the men will carry the bed slats, those thin rails from the bed. The other one will have the white sheet. And they will throw the sheet over the victim. And they will take the bed slats and beat the man to death. The reason they use the sheet is so that the blood doesn't spatter onto them. They use the slats so there's no marks on their hands. They drag the man between the buildings, drop him off, go back to bed. The next morning, the American guards will find that man. They will question the Germans. None of them will have seen or heard anything, because they know if they cooperate, they will be next. In other cases, the Nazis tell the victim, we will spare you this if you just commit suicide. But if you don't, your punishment will be spread to your family back in Germany. We are sending letters back now, and they will round them up. It's estimated that over 300 men were put to death in this fashion. We've only discovered a few of the culprits, and in one case, five of the men that orchestrated one of these murders was put to death at Fort Leavenworth by our government. And their defense was that they are active members of the German military. Being a prisoner of war did not change that. And they used a court-martial and found the man guilty of treason. And they carried out the sentence, no different than we would do in our own army. But of course, that defense didn't carry through, and their executions did. So they were killed for their crimes. One of the guys that I do a lot of work with is a former member of the Luftwaffe. And in 1933, his aunt, who was German, had married a Jewish man. And I guess you could say they saw the writing on the wall. And they fled Germany and came here. Now, when he was captured, he was only 18 years old. And he was brought to prison camps here in the U.S. And his aunt, who had been here, that was 7 years earlier. She had already been here. She went to the colonel of that camp and got permission to visit with him. And she visited with him several times. That was a problem. The other Germans saw that as a problem. And he became fluent in English and read the newspapers. That was a problem. He also worked for the guards. One of the guards was an older man who had no children of his own and kind of sort of adopted him as his child and brought him candy. That was a problem. Unrelated to all of this, my friend was being transferred from his main camp to a work camp. The transfer was not announced until it happened. So that morning, his name was called, and they said, "You and these other 50 guys are being pulled out." His bunkmate came to him and said, "It's a good thing you're leaving. Your name was on the list." So if he had not left, he would have been on that list to be murdered by the Nazis for his crimes of having an aunt who fled Germany and visited him, and a guard who gave him candy and reading English. Interestingly enough, I'll say this now, the man that I'm talking about, he's still alive. I talk with him, we interview. He came back to America. He came back early. He had a friend who was a guard that I mentioned who helped him come back. He came back in 1949, and the Korean War was just around the corner. And everyone, he was unemployed, young guy. They said, "A guy like you is going to get swept up by the army. You're going to go off to Korea." And in our interviews, he said, "I want to go fight in some jungle and die. I knew that as a young man. So I didn't want to get drafted or swept up in the infantry." So what he did, this Luftwaffe veteran, was he joined the American Air Force. And he served there, what he knew already during the Korean War. One of the funniest things about his stories, though, is that one of the places he was stationed at during World War II was outside of Paris. He was part of the occupying troops there. He didn't stay there, of course. But when he joined the American Air Force, one of the places he was stationed at was outside of Paris. So he always found that a little interesting. And he really said he did his best to convince the locals that he was not actually German, but Northern European instead, so there would be no ill will visited upon him. I'm not sure where my time is at. The way this wraps up, I'm going to tell one more part of the prisoner of war story, and then I'll conclude it. This is an important part, and the man I was mentioning to you was one of the guys who went through this part. We had a re-education program here. Now, if you know about the Geneva Convention at all, you know that any attempt to denationalize you, or in other words, to brainwash you, is forbidden. That is illegal. But our government wanted desperately to denazify these Nazis. Keep in mind, also, that the Cold War is on the horizon. We want a Germany that's going to be friendly and helpful. And this is our chance to show these prisoners the values of democracy and get them on our side. We have never violated the Geneva Convention. In fact, I argue that we not only didn't violate it, we went way above and beyond it in the hopes that our boys would be treated above and beyond. And in many cases they were, and many they were not. So the way we get around this requirement is that rather than go to the Nazis and make them be re-educated, because that's illegal, we make the program voluntary. You can volunteer to go through a re-education program on the values of America, American democracy, American government, basically these crash college setups where you would go for 6 weeks to 2 months, and when it was all over, you would love democracy. And we put that out there for the Nazis because we had segregated the Nazis. We were tired of them killing everybody. We segregated them. We put that out there for the Nazis and said, "Here, this is great. How many of you want to volunteer?" Nobody. But we still got 30,000 people that ran through this program. Do you remember I told you a few minutes ago, the men in German uniform weren't all German. They weren't all Nazis. The people who said, "I'll volunteer," were the people from the German Democratic Party who were put in prison for their beliefs. German socialists, that were in prison, I'll volunteer. German communists, I'll volunteer. People that weren't even from Germany and weren't going back to Germany, I'll volunteer. But we took them. We took them into the program. We had a few camps set up specially for this. These crash courses in democracy. They would go through 1945, wrap up the latest groups early 1946, and as a graduation present, one that the guys going into it did not know on the front end, they would be the first to get direct repatriation to Germany. So as soon as the war against Japan ended, and we freed up all the shipping, these were the first guys that got to go back to Germany. That's good if you've been in prison for many years. It's bad if you know how terrible Germany and its economy is in post-World War II period. But you still get to go home. Late 45, early 46, those guys, like my friend, got to go back to Germany. The ones who didn't get re-educated, the Nazis and the others, didn't go back to Europe until summer, fall, 46, spring of 47. And when they did go back to Europe, they weren't taken directly to Germany. But by an agreement with our allies, they were given over to the English, the French, the Belgians, where many of them were kept as POWs for 12 to 24 more months, not being released to Germany at the latest by the end of 1949. And under those occupying powers, they weren't eating all the peanut butter they could eat. They were doing hard work in those war-devastated nations. So that's something that they missed out on, this early repatriation. But that brings me to my conclusion. As the camps were closing down, it happened very rapidly. Camps closed quickly. We consolidated to everybody to these bigger camps. Camp Campbell would shut down. Camp Breckenridge would shut down. All these smaller branch camps would shut down. They would funnel people into places like Fort Knox and some of the other major camps, and then they would funnel them back to Camp Shanks and to Norfolk, Virginia, and to New Orleans, and then send them overseas. In many cases, almost as soon as they quit housing prisoners, there was no evidence left that there ever were prisoners there. In Danville, I mentioned to you that tent city. When that closed down, the prisoners and the American Army policed up the area. There was no sign they had ever been there. In Maysville, that park, baseball field, went back to being a park and baseball field. Documents in the years after this, the documents to prove they were here. Individual camps, the camp commanders, as they're being relieved of their duty to house prisoners of war and being sent on to their next job, take those papers out and destroy them. Dump all those files out. They weren't worth keeping. And at some point, someone said, wait, they are worth keeping. And you'll see them at the National Archives now. Some small places, some small camps will have some things. But most of it's the National Archives. And for researchers like me, when you go there, it's good and it's a blessing in disguise. Because often what you'll see is these long boxes of documents. And the title on that box is usually whatever the first document in that file cabinet was. Prisoner of War Labor Program, all right? And every other document has nothing to do with that first one. But that's what the box is labeled as. So it's kind of search and find stuff, and you can find stuff that other people haven't used, is I guess the upshot of that. But that's the Prisoner of War Program in a nutshell. I hope I touched on Kentucky enough. And if I haven't, I think we have time for questions, and I will be happy to entertain those.
Question.
Did you say that they started these camps in 41?
The prisoner of war camps really didn't start until into 42.
Okay, I was going to say, we didn't.
Yeah, we didn't even have a prisoner. The first prisoner of war came from the Pearl Harbor invasion, but he was actually picked up on December 8th. So that was the first prisoner. He was Japanese, not one of the Germans. We don't see
large numbers of European cruisers coming until really late 42. But we have them. We have them because even though we're not in North Africa yet, we're capturing ships on the high seas. We take a prisoner exchange from England to kind of alleviate the expense that they've been under of keeping these prisoners. We take a large number that way. We also are taking in a lot of what we call enemy aliens or enemy civilians. They don't go to prison of war camp, but they are housed in internment camps. The Japanese American internment being probably very familiar. But we did that with actually German and Italian national civilians, merchants, and et cetera.
You mentioned you discovered in your research some artworks that have been created by Germans. Can you tell us about them?
Sure, yeah. Of course, the talk, I couldn't go into everything I'd like to, but there's a lot of artwork. You have to find it, but here in Kentucky, we actually have a pretty good collection of prisoner art that you can all go see, and it's worth seeing. At Camp Breckenridge, which is now the Camp Breckenridge Museum, but the old Officers Club, one of the POWs housed there, Daniel Mayer, he went in there and painted all these murals. The guards provided him with the paint and the brushes, and he just went in there on his own and kind of beautified the place with these huge murals. I don't know if anyone here has seen those, but they are incredible. In the book, I have a copy, a black and white copy of one of those, but there are these huge murals all along the walls of castles and estates and different things that reminded him and the other Germans of being back home. So at Breckenridge, you have that. Also, if you ever go near the club, as you're coming down that main road, there's a stone wall made out of just little stones stacked up. It runs probably maybe half a mile, three quarters of a mile or so, but that was constructed by Germans as well. Near Elizabethtown, at Fort Knox, the Germans built little replicas of castles out of pebbles. They're about maybe 3 feet high or so. And in Elizabethtown, one of the residents there actually got one of the three that were made at Fort Knox. She got because the former owner of the house was American chaplain who gave services to the Germans. And as a thank you, they gave that to him. And it's kind of funny, I think, because it's just sitting in her front yard. And you drive by and you think, it's just some yard ornament. Nobody really knows its history. So we have that also. And of course, we have cemeteries. At Fort Campbell, there's a cemetery that has the remains of five German POWs there. Four of them died from natural causes. One of them was shot in an escape attempt, and he's buried there. Out at Fort Knox, we have a cemetery, and I don't remember offhand how many graves are there, but I think in the range of 20, 15 German, I think 5 Italian, who died at Fort Knox or at Camp Breckenridge because they were brought to the cemetery at Fort Knox.
Any more questions? Oh, one back here.
Yeah. I don't have a question, but I came to hear this tonight because I experienced this. As a child, I lived in Christian County, and my father's farm bordered Fort Campbell, and I remember having the Germans there to work in the tobacco in the summer, 1 year or maybe two, I don't remember that. I was about 5, but it's just as you said.
I'm actually, Austin P is right there, but I'm actually from Trigg County, so real close. And the big farmer in the area was the Broadbent
yes.
family. And that's an interesting story. I don't want to use up more time than we have, but that's an interesting story because the Broadbents, huge farms, they originally hired 40 Germans from Fort Campbell, and they ended up finding which ones they thought worked good and kept it down to 20. And they hired that same 20 each year. It just so happened those 20 guys were all Austrians. They're from Austria. Now, the relationship they have with the Broadbent family was really good. In fact, the Broadbents got special permission. How they did that? Well, to bring them to church with them, Christmas service, have dinner with the family for Christmas. They exchanged gifts. one of the prisoners dressed up as Santa Claus. I think I mentioned to you that we were friendlier than regulations dictate we should be. They sang carols, they drank a little bit, but at the end of the day, what that did for the Broadbent family was that they went to Austria. They exchanged cars every year with all these prisoners and their families. When they go to Austria about 15 years later, the prisoners have their relatives, their nephews, who are teenagers now, touring them all around Austria. So every stop they're taking in Austria, they've got an escort. So in that regard, I mean, they got good workers out of them. The workers were treated well by the Broadbents. And years later, they stayed in touch. So it worked out.
Thank you, and we hope you'll join us next week, when Professor Wan will be here to tell us about his new book, This is China. So thank you and good evening. We'll be doing some book signings at the table back if you'd like.
Well, thank you for letting me come.